thick piers for that. Look at this cathedral. Its columns bear the entire weight of the roof, but they're slim and widely spaced. Elfric sneered. No one's going to drive a cart across the roof of a church. That's true, but... Merthin stopped. The rain on the cathedral's vast expanse of roof probably weighed more than an ox cart loaded with stone. But why should he explain this to Elfric? It was not his role to educate an incompetent builder. Elfric's design was poor, but Merthin did not want to improve it. He wanted to replace it with his own, so he shut up. Edmund also realized he was wasting his breath. "This decision is not going to be made by you two," he said, and he stomped off. John Constable's baby daughter was christened in the cathedral by Prior Godwin. This honor was granted because he was an important employee of the priory. All the leading townspeople attended. Although John was neither wealthy nor well-connected, his father had worked in the priory stables. Petronilla said that respectable people should take care to show friendship towards him and support for him. Caris thought they condescended to John because they needed him to protect their property. It was raining again, and the people grouped around the font were wetter than the infant who was sprinkled with holy water. Strange feelings stirred in Caris as she looked at the tiny, helpless child. Since lying with Merthin, she had simply refused to let herself think about pregnancy, but, all the same, she felt a warm surge of protective emotion when she saw the baby. She was named Jessica, after Abraham's niece. Caris's cousin Godwin had never been comfortable with babies, and, as soon as the brief rite was over, he turned to leave. But Petronilla grabbed the sleeve of his Benedictine robe. "What about this bridge?" she said. She spoke in a low voice, but Caris heard, and made up her mind to listen to the rest. Godwin said, "I've asked Elfric to prepare drawings and estimates."
"Good. We should keep it in the family."
"Elfric is the priory's builder. Other people may want to horn in. I shall decide who builds the bridge." Caris was annoyed enough to intervene.
"How dare you?" she said to Petronilla.
"I was not speaking to you," her aunt said. Caris ignored that. "Why should Merthin's design not be considered?"
"Because he isn't family. He practically lives with us. But you're not married to him. If you were, it might be different."
Caris knew she was at a disadvantage there, so she shifted her ground.
"You've always been prejudiced against Merthin," she said. "But everyone knows he's a better builder than Elfric."
Her sister Alice heard that and joined in the argument.
"Elfric taught Merthin everything, and now Merthin pretends he knows better."
That was dishonest, Caris knew, and she felt angry.
"Who built the ferry?" she said, raising her voice. "Who repaired the roof of St. Mark's?"
"Merthin was working with Elfric when he built the ferry, and no one asked Elfric about St. Mark's."
"Because they knew he wouldn't be able to solve the problem."
Godwin interrupted.
"Please," he said, with his hands raised in front of himself protectively. "I know you're my family, but I'm the prior and this is the cathedral. I can't be harangued by women folk in public."
Edmund joined the circle.
"Just what I was going to say. Keep your voices down,"
Alice said accusingly.
"You should be supporting your son-in-law."
It occurred to Caris that Alice was getting more like Petronilla. Although she was only 21, and Petronilla was more than twice that age, Alice had the same purse-mouthed look of disapproval. She was also becoming more stout, her bosom filling out the front of her dress like wind in a sail. Edmund looked sternly at Alice.
"This decision will not be made on the basis of family relationships," he said. "The fact that Elfric is married to my daughter won't help his bridge stay upright."
He had strong views on this subject, Caris knew. He believed you should always do business with the most reliable supplier, always hire the best man for the job, regardless of friendship or family ties.
Any man who needs to surround himself with loyal acolytes doesn't really believe in himself, he would say. And if he doesn't believe in himself, why should I? Petronilla said, "So how will the choice be made?" She gave him a shrewd look. "You've obviously got a plan." "The priory and the guild will consider Elfric's design and Merthin's and any others that may be put forward," Edmund said decisively. "All designs must be drawn and costed. The costing must be independently checked by other builders." Alice muttered, "I've never heard of such goings-on. It's like an archery contest. Elfric is the priory's builder. He should do the job." Her father ignored her. "Finally, the designers will be questioned by the leading citizens of the town at a meeting of the parish guild. And then..." He looked at Godwin, who was pretending not to be bewildered by the way the decision process had been taken out of his hands. "And then Prior Godwin will make his choice." The meeting took place in the guild hall at the top of the main street. It had a stone undercroft below and a timber superstructure, topped by a tiled roof and two stone chimneys. In the basement were the large kitchen that prepared food for the banquets, plus a jail and an office for the constable. The main floor was as spacious as a church, 100 feet long and 30 feet wide. At one end was a chapel. Because it was so wide, and because timbers long enough to span a 30-foot roof were rare and expensive, the main room was divided by a row of wooden pillars supporting the joists. It appeared an unpretentious building, made of the materials used in the humblest dwellings, glorifying nobody. But, as Edmund often said, the money made by the people here paid for the limestone and stained glass majesty of the cathedral, and the guild hall was comfortable in its unostentatious way. There were tapestries on the walls and glass in the windows, and two huge fireplaces kept it warm in winter. When business was booming, the food served here was fit for royalty. The parish guild had been formed hundreds of years ago, when Kingsbridge was a small town. A few merchants had got together to raise money to buy ornaments for the cathedral. But when wealthy men eat and drink in a group, they inevitably discuss their common concerns, and fundraising soon became secondary to politics. From the start, the guild was dominated by wool merchants, which was why a huge pair of scales and a standard weight for a woolsack, 364 pounds, stood at one end of the hall. As Kingsbridge grew, other guilds had been formed, representing crafts, carpenters, masons, brewers, goldsmiths, but their leading members also belonged to the parish guild, which retained its primacy. It was a less powerful version of the guild merchant which ruled most English towns, but which was prohibited here by the town's landlord, Kingsbridge Priory. Merthin had never attended a meeting or banquet here, but he had been inside several times on more mundane business. He liked to crane back his neck and study the complex geometry of the roof timbers, a lesson in how the weight of a broad expanse of roof could be funneled down to a few slender wooden pillars. Most of the elements made sense, but one or two pieces of wood seemed to him to be superfluous or even detrimental, transferring weight to weaker zones. That was because no one really knew what made buildings stand up. Builders went by instinct and experience, and sometimes got it wrong. This evening, Merthin was in a state of high anxiety, too nervous to really appreciate the woodwork. The guild was about to pass judgment on his bridge design. It was far superior to Elfric's, but would they see that? Elfric had had the benefit of the tracing floor. Merthin might have asked Godwin for permission to use it, but he had been afraid of further sabotage by Elfric, so he had devised an alternative. He had stretched a large piece of parchment across a wooden frame, and had drawn his design on the skin with a pen and ink. Tonight this might work to his advantage, for he had brought his design with him to the guild hall, so that members would have it in front of them, whereas Elfric's would only be in their memories. He placed his framed drawing at the front of the hall on a three-legged stand he had devised for the purpose. Everyone came and looked at it as they arrived, although they had all seen it at least once over the last few days. They had also climbed the spiral staircase to the loft and looked at Elfric's drawings. Merthyn thought most people preferred his design, but some were wary of backing a youngster against an experienced man. Many had kept their opinions to themselves. The noise level rose as the hall filled up with men and a few women. They dressed up for the guild, as they did for church. The men in expensive wool coats, despite the mild summer weather, the women in elaborate headdresses. Although everyone paid lip service to the untrustworthiness and general inferiority of women, in practice, several of the town's wealthiest and most important citizens were female. There was Mother Cecilia, sitting now at the front with her personal assistant, a nun known as Old Julie. Caris was here. Everyone acknowledged that she was Edmund's right hand. Merthyn experienced a jolt of desire as she sat on the bench next to him, her thigh warm against his own. Anyone carrying on a trade in the town had to belong to a guild. Outsiders could do business only on market days. Even monks and priests were compelled to join if they wanted to trade, which they often did. When a man died, it was common for his widow to continue his enterprise. Betty Baxter was the town's most prosperous baker. Sarah Taverner kept the Holly Bush Inn. It would have been difficult and cruel to prevent such women earning a living. Much easier to include them in the guild. Edmund normally chaired these meetings, sitting on a big wooden throne on a raised platform at the front. Today, however, there were two chairs on the platform. Edmund sat in one and, when Prior Godwin arrived, Edmund invited him to take the other. Godwin was accompanied by all the senior monks, and Merthyn was pleased to see Thomas among them. Philemon was also in the entourage, lanky and awkward, and Merthyn wondered briefly what on earth Godwin had brought him for. Godwin was looking pained. Opening the proceedings, Edmund was careful to acknowledge that the prior was in charge of the bridge, and the choice of design was ultimately his. But everyone knew that, in fact, Edmund had taken the decision out of Godwin's hands by calling this meeting. Provided there was a clear consensus tonight, Godwin would have great difficulty in going against the expressed will of the merchants in a matter of commerce rather than religion. Edmund asked Godwin to begin with a prayer, and Godwin obliged. But he knew he had been outmaneuvered, and that was why he looked as if there was a bad smell. Edmund stood up and said, "These two designs have been costed by Elfric and Merthyn, who have used the same methods of calculation." Elfric interjected, "Of course we have. He learned them from me." There was a ripple of laughter from the older men. It was true. There were formulae for calculating costs per square foot of wall, per cubic yard of infill, per foot of a roof span, and for more intricate work such as arches and vaulting. All builders used the same methods, though with their individual variations. The bridge calculations had been complex, but easier than for a building such as a church. Edmund went on, "Each man has checked the other's calculations, so there is no room for dispute." Edward Butcher called out, "Yes, all builders overcharge by the same amount." That got a big laugh. Edward was popular with the men for his quick wit, and with the women for his good looks and brown bedroom eyes. He was not so popular with his wife, who knew about his infidelities, and had recently attacked him with one of his own heavy knives. He still had a bandage on his left arm. "Elfric's bridge will cost £285, Edmund said, as the laughter died away. "Merthyn's comes out at £307. The difference is £22, as most of you will have worked out faster than me." There was a quiet chuckle at that. Edmund was often teased for having his daughter do his arithmetic for him. He still used the old Latin numerals, because he could not get used to the new Arabic digits that made calculation so much easier. A new voice said,
£22 is a lot of money.
It was Bill Watkin, the builder who had refused to hire Merthin, looking like one of the monks with his bald dome.
Dick Brewer said, "Yes, but Merthin's bridge is twice as wide. It ought to cost twice as much, but it doesn't because it's a cleverer design."
Dick was fond of his own product, ale, and in consequence had a protruding round belly like a pregnant woman.
Bill rejoined, "How many days a year do we need a bridge wide enough for two carts? Every market day and all a fleece fair week."
"Not so," said Bill. "It's only for an hour in the morning and another in the afternoon.
I've waited 2 hours with a cartload of barley before now.
You should have the sense to bring your barley in on quiet days."
"I bring barley in every day."
Dick was the largest brewer in the county. He owned a huge copper kettle that held 500 gallons, in consequence of which his tavern was called the Copper. Edmund interrupted this spat.
"There are other problems caused by delays on the bridge," he said. "Some traders go to Shiring, where there's no bridge and no queue. Others do their business while waiting in line, then go home without ever entering the town, and save themselves the bridge toll and the market taxes. It's forestalling, and it's illegal, but we've never succeeded in stopping it. And then there's the question of how people think of Kingsbridge. Right now we're the town whose bridge collapsed. If we're going to attract back all the business we're losing, we need to change that. I'd like us to become known as the town with the best bridge in England."
Edmund was hugely influential, and Merthin began to scent victory. Betty Baxter, an enormously fat woman in her 40s, stood up and pointed to something on Merthin's drawing.
"What's this? Here in the middle of the bridge parapet, over the pier," she said. "There's a little pointed bit that sticks out over the water, like a viewing platform. What's it for? Fishing?"
The others laughed. "It's a pedestrian refuge," Merthin answered. "If you're walking over the bridge and suddenly the Earl of Shiring rides across with 20 mounted knights, you can step out of their way."
Edward Butcher said, "I hope it's big enough to fit Betty in."
Everyone laughed, but Betty persisted with her questioning.
"Why is the pier underneath it pointed like that all the way down to the water? Alfric's piers aren't pointed."
"To deflect debris. Look at any river bridge. You'll see the piers are chipped and cracked. What do you think causes that damage? It must be the large pieces of wood, tree trunks or timbers from demolished buildings, that you see floating downstream and crashing into piers."
"Orion boatman when he's drunk," said Edward.
"Boats or debris, they will cause less damage to my pointed piers. Elfric's will suffer the full impact."
Elfric said, "My walls are too strong to be knocked down by bits of wood."
"On the contrary," said Merthin, "your arches are narrower than mine. Therefore the water will be drawn through them faster, and the debris will strike the piers with greater force, causing more damage."
He could see from Elfric's face that the older man had not even thought of that, but the audience were not builders. How would they judge what was right? Around the base of each pier, Merthin had drawn a pile of rough stones, known to builders as riprap. This would prevent the current undermining his piers the way it had those of the old wooden bridge, but no one asked him about the riprap, so he did not explain it. Betty had more questions.
"Why is your bridge so long? Elfric's begins at the water's edge. Yours starts several yards inland. Isn't that unnecessary expense?"
"My bridge is ramped at both ends," Merthin explained. "That's so that you step off the bridge onto dry land instead of a swamp. No more ox carts getting bogged down on the beach and blocking the bridge for an hour."
"Cheaper to put down a paved road," said Elfric.
Elfric was beginning to sound desperate. Then Bill Watkin stood up.
"I'm having trouble deciding who's right and who's wrong," he said. "When these two argue, it's difficult to make up your mind. And I'm a builder. It must be worse for those who aren't."
There was a murmur of agreement. Bill went on, "So I think we should look at the men. not the designs. Merthyn had been afraid of this. He listened with increasing despair.
"Which of the two do you know best?" said Bill. "Which can you rely on? Elfrick has been a builder in this town, man and boy, for 20 years. We can look at houses he's put up and see they're still standing. We can see the repairs he's done on the cathedral. On the other hand, here's Merthyn, a clever lad we know, but a bit of a tearaway, and never finished his apprenticeship. There's not a lot to indicate that he's capable of taking charge of the largest building project Kingsbridge has seen since the construction of the cathedral. I know which one I trust." He sat down.
Several men voiced their approval. They would not judge the designs. They would decide on personalities. It was maddeningly unfair. Then Brother Thomas spoke up.
"Has anyone in Kingsbridge ever been involved in a project that involved building below water level?"
Merthyn knew the answer was no. He felt a surge of hope. This could rescue it for him. Thomas went on.
"I would like to know how both men would handle that problem."
Merthyn was ready with his solution, but he was afraid that if he spoke first, Elfrick would simply echo him. He compressed his lips, hoping that Thomas, who usually helped him, would get the message. Thomas caught Merthyn's eye and said,
"Elfrick, what would you do?"
"The answer is simpler than you think," Elfrick said. "You just have to drop loose rubble into the river at the point where your pier will stand. The rubble rests on the river bottom. You put more and more in until the pile is visible above water level. Then you build your pier on that foundation." As Merthyn had expected, Elfrick had come up with the crudest solution to the problem. Now Merthyn said, "There are two snags with Elfrick's method. One is that a pile of rubble is no more stable under water than on land. Over time it will shift and drop, and when that happens, the bridge will subside. If you want a bridge to last only a few years, fine. But I think we should build for the long term." He heard a quiet rumble of concurrence. "The second problem is the shape of the pile. It will naturally slope outwards below the waterline, restricting the passage of boats, especially when the river is low, and Elfrick's arches are already narrow." Elfrick said irritably, "What would you do instead?" Merthyn suppressed a smile. That was what he had wanted to hear, Elfrick admitting that he did not know a better answer. "I'll tell you," he said, "and I'll show everyone that I know better than the idiot who chopped my door to pieces," he thought. He looked around. They were all listening. Their decision hung on what he would say next. He took a deep breath. "First, I would take a pointed wooden stake and pile drive it into the riverbed. Then I would bang in another next to it, touching. Then another. In that way I would build a ring of stakes around the place in the river where I want to put my pier."
"A ring of stakes?" Elfrick jeered. "That will never keep the water out."
Brother Thomas, who had asked the question, said,
"Listen to him, please. He listened to you."
Merthyn said, "Next, I would build a second ring inside the first, with a gap between them of 1/2 foot. He sensed that he had his audience's attention now.
"It still won't be waterproof," said Elfrick. Edmund said, "Shut up, Elfrick. This is interesting."
Merthyn went on. "Then I would pour a clay mortar into the gap between the two rings. The mixture would displace the water, being heavier, and it would plug any chinks between the wood stakes, making the ring watertight. This is called a coffer dam." The room was quiet. "Finally, I would remove the water from inside by bucket, exposing the riverbed, and build a mortared stone foundation." Elfrick was dumbstruck. Both Edmund and Godwin were staring at Merthyn. Thomas said,
"Thank you both. Speaking for myself, that makes the decision an easy one."
"Yes," said Edmund, "I rather think it does."
Caris was surprised that Godwin had wanted Elfric to design the bridge. She understood that Elfric would seem a safer choice, but Godwin was a reformer, not a conservative, and she had expected him to be enthusiastic about Merthyn's clever, radical design. Instead, he had timidly favored the cautious option. Fortunately, Edmund had been able to outmaneuver Godwin, and now Kingsbridge would have a well-built, beautiful bridge that would allow two carts to cross at the same time. But Godwin's eagerness to appoint the unimaginative sycophant, rather than the bold man of talent, was an ominous sign for the future. And Godwin had never been a good loser. When he was a boy, Petronilla had taught him to play chess, letting him win to encourage him, and he had challenged his uncle Edmund. But after being beaten twice, he had sulked and refused to play again. He was in the same mood after the meeting in the guild hall, she could tell. It was probably not that he was particularly attracted to Alfric's design, but he undoubtedly resented having the decision taken out of his hands. Next day, when she and her father went to the prior's house, she anticipated trouble. Godwin greeted them coolly and did not offer any refreshment. As always, Edmund pretended not to notice slights. "I want Merthyn to start work on the bridge immediately," he said as he sat down at the table in the hall. "I have pledges of money for the full amount of Merthyn's budget." "From whom?" Godwin interrupted. "The town's wealthiest traders." Godwin continued to look inquiringly at Edmund. Edmund shrugged and said, £50 from Betty Baxter, 80 from Dick Brewer, 70 from myself, and £10 each from 11 others." "I didn't know our citizens possessed such riches," Godwin said. He seemed both awestruck and envious. "God has been kind." Edmund added, "Kind enough to reward people for a lifetime's hard work and worry." "No doubt. Which is why I need to give them reassurances about the return of their money. When the bridge is built, the tolls will come to the parish guild, which will use them to repay loans. But who will collect the pennies as the passengers cross the bridge? I think it has to be a servant of the guild." "I never agreed to this," Godwin said.
"I know. That's why I'm raising it now."
"I mean, I never agreed to pay the tolls to the parish guild."
"What?"
Caris stared at Godwin, flabbergasted. Of course he had agreed to it. What was he talking about? He had spoken to her as well as to Edmund, and assured them that Brother Thomas...
"Oh,"
she said, "you promised that Thomas would build the bridge, if he was elected prior. Then when Thomas withdrew and you became the candidate, we assumed..."
"You assumed," Godwin said.
A smirk of triumph played about his lips. Edmund could barely contain himself.
"This is not square dealing, Godwin," he said in a choked voice. "You knew what the understanding was."
"I knew no such thing, and you should call me Father Prior." Edmund's voice got louder.
"Then we're back where we were with Prior Anthony 3 months ago.
Except that now, instead of an inadequate bridge, we have no bridge at all. Don't imagine it will be built at no cost to you. Citizens may lend their life savings to the priory on the security of income from the bridge tolls, but they will not give their money away, Father Prior."
"Then they must manage without a bridge. I have only just become prior. How can I start by alienating a right that has belonged to my priory for hundreds of years?"
"But it's only temporary," Edmund exploded. "And if you don't do this, no one will gain any money from bridge tolls, because there will be no cursed bridge."
Caris was furious, but she bit her tongue and tried to figure out what Godwin was up to. He was getting his revenge for last night, but did he really mean it? "What do you want?" she said to him. Edmund looked surprised by the question, but he said nothing. The reason he brought Caris with him to meetings was that she often saw things he missed and asked questions he had not thought of.
"I don't know what you mean,"
Godwin replied. "You've pulled a surprise," she said. "You've caught us wrong-footed. Very well. We admit we made an assumption that may have been unwarranted. But what's your purpose? Just to make us feel stupid?"
"You asked for this meeting, not I."
Edmund burst out, "What kind of way is that, to talk to your uncle and your cousin?"
"Just a minute, Papa," Caris said. Godwin did have a secret agenda, she felt sure, but he did not want to admit it. "All right," she thought, "I'll have to guess it."
"Give me a minute to think," she said.
Godwin still wanted the bridge. He had to. Nothing else made sense. The business about alienating the Priory's ancient rites was rhetoric, the kind of pompous prating that all students were taught at Oxford. Did he want Edmund to break down and agree to Alfric's design? She did not think so. Godwin clearly resented the way Edmund had appealed over his head to the citizenry, but he must see that Merthyn was offering twice as much bridge for almost the same money. So what else could it be? Perhaps he just wanted a better deal. He had looked hard at the Priory's finances, she guessed. Having railed comfortably against Antony's inefficiency for many years, he was now confronted with the reality of having to do the job better himself. Perhaps it was not going to be as easy as he had imagined. Perhaps he was not as clever about money and management as he had thought. In desperation, he wanted the bridge and the money from tolls. But how did he think that could happen? She said, "What could we offer you that would make you change your mind?" "Build the bridge without taking the tolls," he said instantly. So that was his agenda. "You always were a bit sneaky, Godwin," she thought. A flash of inspiration struck her, and she said, "How much money are we talking about?" Godwin looked suspicious. "Why do you want to know that?" Edmund said, "We can work it out. Not counting citizens who don't pay the toll, about 100 people cross the bridge every market day, and carts pay tuppence. It's much less now with the ferry, of course." Caris said, "Say 120 pennies a week, or 10 shillings, which comes to £26 a year." Edmund said, "Then during Fleece Fair week, about 1,000 on the first day, and another 200 each subsequent day. That's 2,200 plus carts, call it 2,400 pennies, which is £10. Total, £36 a year." Caris looked at Godwin. "Is that about right?" "Yes," he acknowledged grudgingly. "So, what you want from us is £36 a year?" "Yes."
"Impossible," said Edmund.
"Not necessarily," Caris said. "Suppose the Priory were to grant the parish guild a lease on the bridge." Thinking on her feet, she added, "Plus an acre of ground at either end, and the island in the middle, for £36 a year, in perpetuity." Once the bridge was built, that land would be priceless, she knew. "Would that give you what you want, Father Prior?" "Yes." Godwin clearly thought he was getting £36 a year for something worthless. He had no idea how much rent could be charged for a plot of land at the end of a bridge. "The worst negotiator in the world is a man who believes he's clever," Caris thought. Edmund said, "But how would the guild recoup the cost of construction?" "With Merthyn's design, the number of people and carts crossing should rise. Theoretically, it could double. Everything over £36 is the guild's. Then we could put up buildings either side to service travellers, taverns, stables, cookshops. They should be profitable. We could charge a good rent."
"I don't know," said Edmund. "It seems very risky to me."
For a moment, Caris felt furious with her father. She had come up with a brilliant solution, and he seemed to be finding unnecessary fault with it. Then she realized he was faking. She could see the light of enthusiasm in his eyes, not quite concealed. He loved the idea, but he did not want Godwin to know how keen he was. He was hiding his feelings, for fear the prior would try to negotiate a better bargain. It was a ploy father and daughter had used before when bargaining over wool. Having figured out what he was up to, Caris played along, pretending to share his misgivings. "I know it's hazardous," she said gloomily. "We could lose everything. But what alternative do we have? We've got our backs to the wall. If we don't build the bridge, we'll go out of business." Edmund shook his head dubiously. "All the same, I can't agree to this on behalf of the guild. I'll have to talk to the people who are putting up the money. I can't say what their reply will be." He looked Godwin in the eye. "But I'll do my best to persuade them, if this is your best offer." Godwin had not actually made an offer, Caris reflected, but he had forgotten that. "It is," he said firmly. "Got you," Caris thought triumphantly.
"You're really very shrewd," Merthyn said.
He was lying between Caris's legs, his head on her thigh, toying with her pubic hair. They had just made love for the second time ever, and he had found it even more joyous than the first. As they dozed in the pleasant daydream of satisfied lovers, she had told him about her negotiation with Godwin. He was impressed. Caris said, "The best of it is, he thinks he's driven a hard bargain. In fact, a perpetual lease on the bridge and the land around it is priceless. All the same, it's a bit dismaying if he's going to be no better at managing the Priory's money than your Uncle Anthony was." They were in the forest, in a clearing hidden by brambles and shaded by a stand of tall beech trees, where a stream ran over rocks to form a pool. It had probably been used by lovers for hundreds of years. They had stripped naked and bathed in the pool before making love on the grassy bank. Anyone travelling clandestinely through the woods would skirt the thicket, so they were not likely to be discovered unless by children picking blackberries, which was how Caris had originally discovered the glade, she told Merthyn. Now, he said idly, "Why did you ask for that island?" "I'm not sure. It's obviously not as valuable as the land at either end of the bridge, and it's no good for cultivation, but it could still be developed. The truth is, I guessed he wouldn't object, so I just threw it in. Will you take over your father's wool business one day?"
"No."
"So definite?
Why?"
"It's too easy for the king to tax the wool trade. He has just imposed an extra duty of a pound per sack of wool. That's on top of the existing tax of 2/3 of a pound. The price of wool is now so high that the Italians are looking for wool from other countries, such as Spain. The business is too much at the mercy of the monarch. Still, it's a living. What else would you do?" Merthyn was edging the conversation towards marriage, a subject she never raised.
"I don't know."
She smiled. "When I was 8, I wanted to be a doctor. I thought that if I had known about medicine, I could have saved my mother's life. They all laughed at me. I didn't realize only men could be physicians." "You could be a wise woman, like Mattie. That would shock the family. Imagine what Petronilla would say. Mother Cecilia thinks it's my destiny to be a nun." He laughed. "If she could see you now." He kissed the soft inside of her thigh. "She'd probably want to do what you're doing," Caris said. "You know what people say about nuns." "Why would she think you wanted to join the convent?"
"It's because of what we did after the bridge collapsed. I helped her take care of the injured. She said I had a natural gift for it."
"You have. Even I could see it."
"I just did what Cecilia said. But people seemed to feel better as soon as you spoke to them. And then you always listened to what they had to say before telling them what they should do."
She stroked his hair. "I couldn't be a nun. I'm too fond of you." Her triangle of hair was reddish-brown with golden lights.
"You've got a little mole," he said. "Right here, on the left, beside the cleft."
"I know. It's been there since I was a little girl. I used to think it was ugly. I was so pleased when my hair grew, because I thought that meant my husband wouldn't see it.
I never imagined anyone would look as closely as you. Friar Murdo would call you a witch. You'd better not let him see it.
Not if he were the last man on earth.
This is the blemish that saves you from blasphemy.
What are you talking about?
In the Arab world, every work of art has a tiny flaw, so that it doesn't sacrilegiously compete with the perfection of God.
How do you know that?
One of the Florentines told me.
Listen, do you think the parish guild will want the island?
Why do you ask?
Because I'd like to own it.
4 acres of rock and rabbits?
Why?
I'd build a dock and a builder's yard. Stone and timber coming by river could be delivered directly to my dock. When the bridge is finished, I'd build a house on the island.
Nice idea, but they wouldn't give it to you for free.
How about as part payment for building the bridge? I could take, say, half wages for 2 years.
You charge 4 pence a day, so the price of the island would be just over £5.
I should think the guild would be pleased to get that much for barren land.
Do you think it's a good idea?
I think you could build houses there and rent them as soon as the bridge is finished, and people can travel to and from the island easily.
Yes, said Merthyn thoughtfully. I'd better talk to your father about it.
Chapter 26. Returning to Earl's castle at the end of a day's hunting, when all the men in Earl Rowland's entourage were in a good mood, Ralph Fitzgerald was happy. They crossed the drawbridge like an invading army, knights and squires and dogs. Rain was falling in a light drizzle, coolly welcome to the men and animals, who were hot and tired and content. They had taken several summer fat hinds that would make good eating, plus a big old stag, too tough for anything but dog meat, killed for its magnificent antlers. They dismounted in the outer compound, within the lower circle of the figure-eight moat. Ralph unsaddled Griff, murmured a few words of thanks in his ear, fed him a carrot, and handed him to a groom to be rubbed down. Kitchen boys dragged away the bloody carcasses of the deer. The men were noisily recalling the day's incidents, boasting and jeering and laughing, remembering remarkable jumps and dangerous falls and hair's breadth escapes. Ralph's nostrils filled with a smell he loved, a mixture of sweating horses, wet dogs, leather, and blood. Ralph found himself next to Lord William of Castor, the Earl's elder son.
"A great day's sport," he said.
"Tremendous,"
William agreed. He pulled off his cap and scratched his balding head.
"I'm sorry to lose old Bruno, though."
Bruno, the leader of the dog pack, had gone in for the kill a few moments too early. When the stag was too exhausted to run any farther and turned to face the hounds, its heaving shoulders covered with blood, Bruno had leaped for its throat. But with a last burst of defiance, the deer had dipped its head and swung its muscular neck and impaled the soft belly of the dog on the points of its antlers. The effort finished the beast off, and a moment later the other dogs were tearing it apart. But as it thrashed its life away, Bruno's guts unraveled across the antlers like a tangled rope, and William had to put him out of his misery, slashing his throat with a long dagger.
"He was a brave dog," Ralph said, and put a hand on William's shoulder in commiseration.
"Like a lion," William agreed.
On the spur of the moment, Ralph decided to speak about his prospects. There would never be a better moment. He had been Roland's man for 7 years. He was brave and strong. And he had saved his lord's life after the bridge collapsed. Yet he had been given no promotion and was still a squire. What more could be asked of him? Yesterday he had met his brother, by chance, at a tavern on the road from Kingsbridge to Shiring. Merthyn, on his way to the Priory's quarry, had been full of news. He was going to build the most beautiful bridge in England. He would be rich and famous. Their parents were thrilled. It had made Ralph feel even more frustrated. Now, speaking to Lord William, he could not think of a neat way to introduce the subject that was on his mind, so he just plunged in.
It's 3 months since I saved your father's life at Kingsbridge. Several people claim that honor, William said. The harsh look that came over his face reminded Ralph strongly of Roland. I pulled him out of the water. And Matthew Barber mended his head, and the nuns changed his bandages, and the monks prayed for him. God saved his life, though.
Amen, Ralph said. All the same, I was hoping for some sign of favor.
My father's a hard man to please. William's brother Richard was standing nearby, red-faced and sweating, and he overheard the remark. That's as true as the Bible, he said. Don't complain, William said. Our father's hardness made us strong. As I recall, it made us miserable. William turned away, probably not wanting to argue the point in front of an underling. When the horses were stabled, the men drifted across the compound, past the kitchens and barracks and chapel, to a second drawbridge that led to a small inner compound, the top loop of the figure eight. Here the Earl lived in a traditional keep, with ground-floor storerooms, a great hall above, and a small upper story for the Earl's private bedchamber. A colony of rooks inhabited the high trees around the keep and strutted on the battlements like sergeants, cawing their dissatisfaction. Roland was in the great hall, having changed out of his dirty hunting clothes into a purple robe. Ralph stood near the Earl, determined to raise the question of his promotion at the first opportunity. Roland was arguing good-naturedly with William's wife, Lady Philippa, one of the few people who could contradict him and get away with it. They were talking about the castle.
I don't think it's changed for 100 years, Philippa said.
That's because it's such a good design, Roland said, speaking out of the left side of his mouth. The enemy expends most of his strength getting into the lower compound. Then he faces a whole new battle to reach the keep.
Exactly, said Philippa. It was built for defense, not comfort. But when was the last time a castle in this part of England came under attack? Not in my lifetime.
Nor in mine.
He grinned with the mobile half of his face.
Probably because our defenses are so strong.
There was a bishop who scattered acorns on the road wherever he travelled, to protect him from lions. When they told him there were no lions in all England, he said, "It's more effective than I thought." Roland laughed. Philippa added, "Most noble families nowadays live in more comfortable homes." Ralph did not care for luxury, but he cared for Philippa. He gazed at her voluptuous figure as she talked, unaware of him. He imagined her lying beneath him, twisting her naked body, crying out in pleasure, or pain, or both. If he were a knight, he could have a woman like that. "You should knock down this old keep and build a modern house," she was saying to her father-in-law. "One with big windows and lots of fireplaces. You could have the hall at ground level, with the family apartments at one end, so that we could all have somewhere private to sleep when we come to visit you, and the kitchens at the other end, so that the food is still hot when it reaches the table." Suddenly Ralph realized he could make a contribution to this conversation.
"I know who could design such a house for you," he said.
They turned to him in surprise. What would a squire know of house design?
"Who?" said Philippa.
"My brother Merthin."
She looked thoughtful.
"The funny-faced boy who tells me to buy green silk to match my eyes."
He meant no disrespect.
I'm not sure what he meant.
Is he a builder?
He's the best, Ralph said proudly. He devised the new ferry at Kingsbridge. Then he figured out how to repair the roof of St. Mark's when no one else could, and now he's been commissioned to build the most beautiful bridge in England.
Somehow I'm not surprised, she said.
What bridge? Said Roland.
The new one at Kingsbridge. It will have pointed arches, like a church, and be wide enough for 2 carts.
I've heard nothing of this, Roland said.
Ralph realized the Earl was displeased. What had annoyed him?
"The bridge must be rebuilt, mustn't it?" Ralph said.
"I'm not so sure," Roland replied. "Nowadays there's hardly enough business for two markets as close together as Kingsbridge and Shiring.
But if we must accept the Kingsbridge market, that doesn't mean we have to countenance a blatant attempt by the Priory to steal customers from Shiring."
Bishop Richard had come in, and now Roland rounded on him.
"You didn't tell me about the new bridge at Kingsbridge."
"Because I don't know about it," Richard answered.
"You ought to. You're the bishop."
Richard flushed at the reproof. The Bishop of Kingsbridge has lived in or near Shiring ever since the civil war between King Stephen and the Empress Maud, 2 centuries ago. The monks prefer it that way, and so do most bishops.
"That doesn't prevent you keeping your ear to the ground. You should have some idea of what's happening there."
"Since I don't, perhaps you'd be kind enough to tell me what you've learned."
That kind of cool insolence passed over Roland's head.
"It's going to be wide enough for 2 carts.
It will take business away from my market at Shiring."
"There's nothing I can do about it."
"Why not? You're the abbot ex officio. The monks are supposed to do what you say."
"They don't, though."
"Perhaps they will if we take away their builder."
"Ralph, can you persuade your brother to give up the project?"
"I can try."
"Offer him a better prospect. Tell him I want him to build a new palace for me, here, at Earl's Castle."
Ralph was excited to get a special commission from the Earl, but he was daunted, too. He had never been able to talk Merthyn into anything. It was always the other way around.
"All right," he said. "Will they be able to go ahead without him?"
He got the job because no one else in Kingsbridge knew how to build underwater. Richard said, "He's not the only man in England who can design a bridge, obviously." William said,
"Still, taking away their builder would surely delay them. They probably couldn't start for another year."
"Then it's worth doing," Roland said decisively.
A look of hatred came over the animated half of his face, and he added,
"That arrogant prior has to be put in his place."
Things had changed in the life of Gerald and Maud, Ralph discovered. His mother wore a new green dress to church, and his father had leather shoes. Back at home there was a goose stuffed with apples roasting over the fire, filling the little house with a mouth-watering smell, and a loaf of wheat bread, the most expensive kind, standing on the table. The money came from Merthyn, Ralph soon learned.
"He gets paid 4 pence a day every day he works on St. Mark's," Maud said proudly, "and he's building a new house for Dick Brewer. That's as well as getting ready to build the new bridge."
Merthyn received a lower wage for working on the bridge, he explained while his father carved the goose, because he had been given Leper Island in part payment. The last remaining leper, old and bedridden, had been moved to a small house in the monk's orchard on the far side of the river. Ralph found that his mother's evident happiness left a sour taste in his mouth. He had believed, since he was a boy, that the destiny of the family lay in his hands. He had been sent away, at the age of 14, to join the household of the Earl of Shiring, and he had known even then that it was up to him to wipe out his father's humiliation by becoming a knight, perhaps a baron, even an earl. Merthyn, by contrast, had been apprenticed to a carpenter and set on a road that could only lead farther down the social hill. Builders were never made knights. It was some consolation that their father was unimpressed by Merthyn's success. He showed signs of impatience when Maud talked about building projects.
"My elder son seems to have inherited the blood of Jack Builder, my only low-born ancestor," he said, and his tone was amazed rather than proud. "But Ralph, tell us how you're getting on at the court of Earl Roland."
Unfortunately,
Ralph had so far mysteriously failed to rise in the nobility, whereas Merthyn was buying his parents new clothes and expensive dinners. Ralph knew he should just be grateful that one of them had won success, and that even if his parents remained humble, they could at least be comfortable. But though his mind told him to rejoice, his heart seethed with resentment. And now he had to persuade his brother to give up the bridge. The trouble with Merthyn was that he would never see anything simply. He was not like the knights and squires with whom Ralph had spent the last 7 years. They were fighting men. In their world, loyalties were clear, bravery was the virtue, and the issue was life or death. There was never much need for deep thought. But Merthyn thought about everything. He could not play a game of checkers without suggesting a change in the rules. He was explaining to their parents why he had accepted 4 acres of barren rock in part payment for his work on the bridge. "Everyone thinks the land is worthless because it's an island," he said. "What they don't realize is that when the bridge is built, the island will become part of the city. Townspeople will walk across the bridge just as they walk along the main street, and 4 acres of city land is very valuable. If I build houses on it, the rents will be worth a fortune." Gerald said, "You've a few years to wait before then. I'm getting some income from it already. Jake Chepstow is renting 1/2 acre to use as a timber yard. He's bringing logs from Wales." "Why from Wales?" Gerald asked. "The New Forest is nearer. Their wood should be cheaper."
"It should be. But the Earl of Shaftesbury charges a toll or a tax at every river ford and bridge in his territory." It was a familiar gripe. Many lords found ways to tax goods that passed through their territories. As they started to eat, Ralph said to Merthyn, "I bring you news of another opportunity. The Earl wants to build a new palace at Earl's Castle." Merthyn looked suspicious. "He sent you to ask me to design it?"
"I suggested you. Lady Philippa was berating him about how old-fashioned the keep is, and I said I knew the right person to talk to." Maud was thrilled.
"Isn't that wonderful?"
Merthyn remained skeptical. "And the Earl said he wanted me?"
"Yes. Amazing. A few months ago I couldn't get a job. Now I've got too much to do. And Earl's Castle is 2 days away. I don't see how I could build a palace there and a bridge here at the same time."
"Oh, you'll have to give up the bridge," Ralph said.
"What?"
"Work for the Earl has to take precedence over everything else, naturally."
"I'm not sure that's right."
"Take it from me. Did he say that?"
"Yes.
As a matter of fact, he did."
Their father joined in.
"This is a marvelous opportunity, Merthyn," he said, "to build a palace for an earl."
"Of course it is," Merthyn replied. "But a bridge for this town is at least as important."
"Don't be stupid," his father said.
"I do my best not to be," Merthyn said sarcastically.
"The Earl of Shiring is one of the great men of the land. The Prior of Kingsbridge is a nobody by comparison."
Ralph cut a slice of goose thigh and put it in his mouth, but he could hardly swallow. He had been afraid of this. Merthyn was going to be difficult. He would not take orders from their father either. He had never been obedient, even as a child. Ralph felt desperate.
"Listen," he said, "the Earl doesn't want the new bridge to be built. He thinks it will take business away from Shiring."
"Ah, ha!" said Gerald. "You don't want to go up against the Earl, Merthyn."
"Is that what's behind this, Ralph?" Merthyn asked. "Is Roland offering me this job just to prevent the building of the bridge?"
"Not just for that reason.
But it's a condition. If I want to build his palace, I must abandon the bridge."
Gerald said with exasperation,
"You don't have a choice, Merthyn. The Earl doesn't request, he commands."
Ralph could have told him that an argument based on authority was not the way to persuade Merthyn. Merthyn said,
I don't think he can command the Prior of Kingsbridge, who has commissioned me to build this bridge.
But he can command you.
Can he? He's not my lord.
Don't be foolish, son. You can't win a fight with an earl.
I don't think Roland's quarrel is with me, father. This is between the earl and the prior. Roland wants to use me as a hunter uses a dog. But I think I'd do better to stay out of the fight.
I think you should do what the earl says. Don't forget, he's your kinsman, too.
Merthyn tried a different argument. Has it occurred to you what a betrayal this would be of Prior Godwin?
Gerald made a disgusted noise.
What loyalty do we owe the priory? It was the monks who forced us into penury.
And your neighbours? The people of Kingsbridge among whom you've lived for 10 years? They need the bridge. It's their lifeline.
We are of the nobility, his father said. We're not required to take into account the needs of mere merchants.
Merthyn nodded. You may feel that way, but as a mere carpenter, I can't share your view.
This isn't just about you,
Ralph burst out. He had to come clean, he realized. The Earl has given me a mission. If I succeed, he may make me a knight, or at least a minor lord. If I fail, I could remain a squire. Maud said, It's very important that we all try to please the Earl. Merthyn looked troubled. He was always willing to go head to head with their father, but he did not like to argue with Mother.
I've agreed to build the bridge, he said. The town is counting on me. I can't give it up.
Of course you can, Maud said. I don't want to get a reputation for unreliability.
Everyone would understand if you gave the Earl precedence.
They might understand, but they wouldn't respect me for it.
You should put your family first.
I fought for this bridge, Mother, Merthyn said stubbornly. I made a beautiful design, and I persuaded the whole town to have faith in me. No one else can build it, not the way it should be done.
If you defy the Earl, it will affect Ralph's whole life, she said.
Don't you see that? His whole life shouldn't depend on something like this.
But it does. Are you willing to sacrifice your brother just for the sake of a bridge?
Merthyn said, I suppose it's a bit like my asking him to save men's lives by not going to war.
Gerald said, Come now. You can't compare a carpenter to a soldier.
That was tactless, Ralph thought. It showed Gerald's preference for the younger son. Merthyn felt the sting, Ralph could tell. His brother's face reddened, and he bit his lip as if to restrain himself from a combative reply. After a pause, Merthyn spoke in a quiet voice that Ralph knew to be a sign that he had made up his mind irrevocably.
I didn't ask to be a carpenter, he said. Like Ralph, I wanted to be a knight.
A foolish aspiration for me, I know that now. All the same, it was your decision that I should be what I am. As things have turned out, I'm good at it. I'm going to make a success of what you forced me into. One day, I'd like to build the tallest building in England. This is what you made me, so you'd better learn to live with it. Before Ralph went back to Earl's Castle with the bad news, he racked his brains for a way to turn defeat into victory. If he could not talk his brother into abandoning the bridge, was there some other way he could get the project cancelled or delayed? There was no point talking to Prior Godwin or Edmund Wooler, he was sure. They would be more committed to the bridge even than Merthyn. And anyway, they would not be persuaded by a mere squire. What could the Earl do? He might send a troop of knights to kill the construction workers, but that could cause more problems than it solved. It was Merthyn who gave him the idea. He had said that Jake Chepstow, the timber merchant, who was using Leper Island as a storeyard, was buying trees from Wales to avoid the taxes charged by the Earl of Shaftesbury. My brother feels he must accept the authority of the Prior of Kingsbridge, Ralph said to Earl Roland on his return. Before the Earl had time to get angry, he added, But there may be a better way to delay the building of the bridge. The Priory's quarry is in the heart of your earldom, between Shiring and Earl's Castle.
But it belongs to the monks, Roland growled. The king gave it to them centuries ago. We can't stop them taking stone.
You could tax them, though, Ralph said. He felt guilty. He was sabotaging a project dear to his brother's heart. But it had to be done, and he quelled his conscience. They will be transporting their stone through your earldom.
Their heavy cart